Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show, live in the green space today, and boy, do we have a treat for you now. Three guests taking part here in New York tonight in the Satire Summit 2016. It's called Beyond Parody, an evening exploring why political satire is such a potent force in American culture and politics today. It's at 7:30 tonight at the Star Foundation Hall at the New School, sponsored by the News Literacy Project. WNYC is a co-sponsor, and we are so lucky to have with us here in the green space Alexander Petri, Washington Post columnist and author of its blog delicately titled Compost; Ashley Nicole Black, writer and correspondent for Samantha Bee's late night show on TBS, Full Frontal with Samantha Bee; and drumroll please for this audience, the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Peter Sagal.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome, 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 welcome. I see you're doing this summit in the name of news literacy, which is a very serious topic for funny people to gather around. Can you each talk about the relationship between making people laugh in the ways that you do, or that you follow, for that matter, and the mission to enhance news literacy? Ashley, you want to start?
Sure. If people weren't bad at news literacy, I wouldn't have a job. So thank you, America. A lot of what we do in making comedy is just putting two things next to each other that, like, had people been paying attention to the news, they would have known. And you just get a laugh out of that. I actually saw a great video today online where someone cut in the narrator from Arrested Development into the presidential debate. So someone says, "I never said that." And he says, "Yes, he did." And that's enough, you know, to make comedy these days when people are going on TV saying things they didn't say or saying things they said that we have videotape of them saying.
Peter Sagal, you're definitely in the news literacy business.
I kind of have to be. I mean, as Ashley was saying, you know, it's hard to make jokes for or with people if the people you're making jokes with and for don't have any idea what you're talking about. So, you know, if this is public radio, you and me both, brother. By the way, who here in the stage looks like a public radio host, everybody? And visual joke. I've been in the medium for a while. And, you know, our audience especially, we make informed jokes for an informed audience. And if the informed audience goes away, I'll have to go back to doing something else, and I'm not qualified to do anything else. So this is really sort of a question of personal survival.
But it's so accessible that a lot of people come to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me without all the knowledge of the news this week, and they learn a lot by listening to the show.
Mostly about farts and people trying to smuggle exotic animals in their pants, which I feel we cover in a way that the rest of the public media does not. That's really our beat. So we'll always have that, you know, whatever happens in terms of civilization. I mean, I imagine if Trump gets elected and we're all sitting around in our tribes in the ruins scrounging for food, I'll still be able to make a living. I'll have to go campfire to campfire because, of course, our infrastructure will be destroyed. But nonetheless, I will come to your camp somewhere in the ruins of the American cities and make fart jokes. And presumably, I will still make a living. Instead of money, I'll be given canned goods and ammunition. But I guess I'm ready for the post-Trump economy is what I'm saying.
And somehow we'll all be more informed by that, but I'm still trying to make the connection.
I understand. I'm sorry.
Alexander, do you think news literacy has been a challenge in specific ways to this election cycle?
Oh, absolutely, because I think everyone lives in a bizarre little cave of information. So if you're hanging out on Facebook, you're seeing all these headlines that are like, hey, did you notice that, like, Hillary Clinton eats babies every day? And it's like, I didn't know that, actually.
And yet she's so slender. How did she know?
No, exactly. It's all of those secret naps that she's been taking with her, like, electrolysis meter.
Right.
So the funny thing is, if you don't have the same set of information, it's hard to, like, write jokes to people. So I will often, like, you'll write something with, like, a headline that's clearly sort of bizarre and exaggerated. It'll be like, oh, Hillary Clinton is simultaneously Satan, which, by the way, Alex Jones, he has a highly placed source. I don't know if anyone else is following, like, the Satan beat, because I am all about this beat. But basically, he's like is a highly placed source who knows that President Obama is covered in flies because he is the lord of the flies, and so is Hillary, and they both smell of sulfur.
I should say at this point, she's not making that up.
Yeah, no, and my favorite thing about this is, like, this person, ostensibly this high-placed source, like, went to Alex Jones, told him, told no one else, went back to their job, just was like, yeah, you know, I work for Satan, that's cool. Not concerned otherwise. But I think if you, that's a legitimate news story that some people are, like, gonna come up to you after a rally and tell you about. And so where is the room for, you know, making jokes if that's, like, a true news thing?
So let's listen to and talk about each of your work a little bit now that we've established that Alex Jones has the realities of the universe. Here's a minute and a half, and heaven and hell. Here's a minute and a half from Full Frontal with Samantha Bee that features Ashley Nicole Brown. It's the last part of a piece with Samantha and others about white conservatives saying they don't support Black Lives Matter because they think it's the opposite of all lives matter, therefore it's racist. So Ashley tells them more about the context of Black Lives Matter and that phrase, and then asks some of them if learning more information might change their minds on the topic. The first response is, let's say, not encouraging.
Probably not going to change my mind on the opinion, on the topic, right?
So learning more information wouldn't change your mind?
No, not on this topic, no.
So there's nothing Black Lives Matter could do to make you want to know more about them?
No.
But the good news is, aside from this state Senate candidate with cotton in his ears, most people we talked to did want to understand, at least when faced with an actual Black person forcing them to think critically about what they were about to say.
Do you think it's possible that sometimes Black people get more scrutiny from police than other people?
Absolutely. It's certainly possible.
I support the police 100%, but when people have real grievances, I also support that, getting to the root of the matter.
As a white person, I always feel like no matter what I say, it's going to be offensive, and I don't want to be that way. I want to be able to reach. I want to be able to reach out to you, because, again, I'm in this little white skin, and so I've never had to totally relate to that. I want to.
I don't know whether to say African-American or Black, and I get nervous because I don't want to say the wrong thing. Anyway, that's just one example, like, of learning how to communicate better.
You want a trick?
Yes.
You could ask the person.
There you go. Thank you.
What would you prefer to be called?
What would you prefer to be called?
I prefer to be called Black. Would you say Black Lives Matter?
Yes, of course Black Lives Matter, but not in the sense of, like, am I a supporter of that movement? I don't know enough about it.
So you would say Black Lives Matter pending research.
Yeah.
Bad news, Donald Trump. White conservatives are creeping ever closer to getting woke for something other than brunch.
Want to talk about that piece?
Yeah, the first guy that you showed is actually a prosecutor. And he had
Where
said,
was that?
Well, that was at the RNC. I don't remember. He actually, his state name is on his lapel, but I don't remember where he was from. But he said that his problem with Black Lives Matter is that people jump to protest before they find out the full story of what's going on. Like with Mike Brown, people just jumped and they didn't even know the whole story. And I said, well, what about the DOJ investigation that ended up showing that the city really was overfining people? He said, oh, I've never heard of that. And he's a prosecutor. So that's where we are. It's like, how can we have an honest conversation about a problem when half of the country has one set of information, half the country has a different set of information, and nobody's willing to look into what the other half has?
So Samantha Bee and John Oliver and Trevor Noah and others on television, plus Wait on the radio, are always blowing the whistle on bad news reporting and attempts to mislead the public through the media, fighting news illiteracy and doing things like we just heard there, which on the one hand was really, really funny, and on the other hand was really, really serious and had very serious moments that were unfunny. Our main news literacy shows in America today seem to be comedy shows. And I wonder if, Ashley, I'll stay with you, does that make you go like, yay us, or does it make you wonder what our country is coming to if the best explanatory journalism that reaches big audiences is through comedians and satirists rather than straight journalists?
Oh, I think it's terrifying. We won an award for being like the best news show this year. That is utterly terrifying. I went to school to write fart jokes and jokes about my period. Like, that is what I'm here to do. You know, it's very scary, but I think that we've gotten so entrenched into our little camps that comedy might be the only thing that gets someone to peek out of their camp and see something they wouldn't have seen otherwise.
You want to pick it up, Peter?
Yeah, I agree. People come up to me and they say, oh, I get all my news from your show. And I say, oh, no, that's terrible. Don't do that. You need to be, like, reading the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or, like, serious journalism or watching serious journalism on TV. Don't trust me. I'm lying. I'm making stuff up for comedy. But one of the things that I think has happened is that current events, such as we have seen play out now for more than a decade, have exceeded the ability of journalism to adequately explain it. So, for example, and this is a dated example, I know, but it comes to mind, when Sarah Palin said that she had foreign policy experience because, or credentials, because you can see Russia from Alaska. She didn't say, by the way, from her house. That was Tina Fey. Like ABC News sent a camera crew to check to see if that's true, you know. And CNN had one of their panel discussions. Well, does that give her credibility? Does it not? I don't know. Left, right, center, whatever. And on my show, I said, I can see Lake Michigan from my office. Does that make me a sturgeon? And I think that that kind of response to something as on its face ridiculous as that is in fact the best response. And comedy gives me or people and the people I work with and people like Samantha and Ashley and Alexandra, everybody, a way to speak the truth and get away with it.
Alexandra?
Well, I think the trouble, though, is that reality keeps sort of outrunning you. So there was one week during this campaign season when Donald Trump was complaining about the judge because he's like, oh, well, he's Mexican and he can't possibly rule fairly. And I'm like, oh, by the end of the week, he'll be saying female judges can't rule. And then by the end of the week, he was saying female judges couldn't rule on him.
That's a whole other problem. So, is we can't keep up with reality these days.
Here is a minute from last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's Peter with an audience contestant plus panelist Helen Hong. Peter speaks first.
Jenny, welcome to the show. You're going to play Who's Bill? This time, Bill Curtis, of course, is going to perform for you three quotations from the week's news. Your job, correctly identify or explain two of them. You've heard me say this before. You know how this works. Are you ready to play?
Yep.
All right. Here is your first quote.
Senator, you whipped out that Mexican thing again.
That?
Pa-pow.
That was one of the more memorable lines from a pretty unmemorable event on Tuesday night. What was it?
The vice presidential debate.
The vice presidential debate. Yes. We've got I paid for this microphone and you're no Jack Kennedy. And now we can add you whipped out the Mexican thing again. To the pantheon of great debate comments, it's so presidential. We can all imagine Ronald Reagan saying, Mr. Russian guy, tear down that Berlin thing.
I've experienced a whipping out of a Mexican thing.
Have you now?
And it wasn't as unpleasant as he made it sound.
Oh. Really?
I just...
That was a great punchline. You went all the way there.
Yeah, we did. And somewhere in L.A., a guy named Diego said, yes, indeed.
I'm curious, and I bet a lot of public radio listeners would be curious, how much of what you come in with every week is written, and how much is you doing, like, group improv?
Well, it's more the latter than you'd think. I have a really great staff with whom I research and write the show and rewrite it. I'm sure... my colleagues here would agree that comedy is rewriting and rewriting. And then we take all this stuff that we've prepared and we go in and our panelists, who are extremely talented and wonderful people, often come up with better stuff off the top of their heads than we were able to think about all week, which is somewhat aggravating. But nonetheless, it always... It's humbling. It's humbling. But I think, you know, the one thing that I think our show offers compared to the absolute, you know, brilliance of Samantha Bee and all the other guys is that we have a genuinely improvisational experience. It's all happening in real time. I had no idea Helen Hong was going to say that, and I would willing to bet that neither did she.
I'm going to play one question game of Verify Wikipedia with Peter Sagal.
Oh, God, no.
The Wikipedia entry on you says you grew up in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey.
Hey, shout out to my homeboys.
And your brother... So true. Your brother, Doug, is the rabbi at Temple Emmanuel in Westfield.
He is. Shana Tutva to everybody out there. He is. he came back to New Jersey after a life of working elsewhere. And I remember him calling me when he was offered this job. It's 5 miles from where he grew up. And he said, Peter, it's a great job. And I said, that's great. You deserve it. He says, Peter, I'm going to take it. I said, that's great. He said, Peter, I'm going to die here. And I said, yeah. Yeah, well, I'll come to New York sometimes. You can come across the bridge and visit me because I ain't never going there.
But really, the Jews in Westfield have a choice on the Sabbath. Go to shul with your brother.
Exactly.
Or listen to you on WNYC where your show airs at 11 o'clock Saturday morning.
Yes, they have that choice, and I'm sure they'll choose wisely.
Yes. Did you think when you launched the show that it would be this whole Cain and Abel thing?
Yeah, well, we have technology now with time shifting, so I'm sure.
Really?
Yeah, what they can do is they can wait, and then on Sunday listen to the podcast at the Shabbat service. So I think...
Good solution.
Yeah.
Alexandra, your Washington Post blog, Compost, it's about sustainable waste management, I guess.
Yes. No, my mom's friends still think it's a gardening blog, actually.
I see your Compost entry yesterday was about how you finally realized that you must finally disavow Donald Trump in light of the unusual behavior by him of the last week.
Well, exactly. He's not the man I thought he was. I know all through... All throughout that campaign, I thought this is a man who respects women. And when he was sitting there staring at his baby daughter, Tiffany, and saying, man, I wonder if she's going to get breasts like her mom. I thought this is a man who's presidential.
Right.
But this week, though, it was a total surprise. I was blindsided that he might not have the respect for women that it seemed like he'd been sort of nursing, especially during that Megyn Kelly, where he was just so fully, fully respectful throughout. And not insinuating anything.
You also wrote a column about Trump's, quote, locker room talk that takes us inside an actual made-up locker room. Was this an investigative report?
Oh, yes. I covered myself in a large raincoat, and I crept indoors. And no, it wasn't actually investigative. I couldn't get beyond the raincoat. Because the thing about locker rooms, I feel like, at least in my experience of ladies' locker rooms, is there's always like a group of very comfortable people who are very happy to be nude. And like, you're sitting there and they're very comfortable and you're like increasingly uncomfortable and they're just like talking and like half an hour passes and you're like sitting there furtively putting your trench coat on. But that's why I don't hang out in locker rooms as often as I should. But no, yeah, investigatively.
Yeah, I do see that one guy in the locker room boasted that he is a lady killer. And someone actually objected. Do I have that right?
Yeah, no. And then that person was shunned and kicked out of the locker room.
Yes. PC ruins everything, doesn't it?
It does. Well, I've been amazed, actually, over the last week how many people have sort of stepped up and said, you know, I've been a locker all my life. And people, I just sat there while people said these things. I'm the real victim here. I'm amazed because I feel like I know guys who've talked in that way and I've like sat there uncomfortably and like laughed along or like that was during college. And now I like stalk away and I throw coffee in their faces and, you know, like I do a thing. But like the number of guys who are like, I've never heard anything like what he said. It baffles me. I'm like, really? Like you must be hanging out with Michelle Obama and that's wonderful. But I don't know.
My locker room talk, growing up, you know, public radio guy, was usually something along the lines of, guys, would you let me out of this locker? Guys? Hey, guys. It's dark in here. And I don't have my inhaler. Guys?
Let's see if we can get Ann in Westchester on the phone here. Control room, can you punch up Ann for me? Sorry, everybody. We've been having problems on and off with the phones
morning. Can I jump in and say the reason that I'm here with these two very funny people is that tonight we're doing an event for the News Literacy Project, which is out there trying to help young people understand how to do the news. It's an event tonight at, let me get this right, the Tishman Auditorium at the New School. And if you'd like to come, you can pick up tickets by just Googling Satire Summit NLP, and we can see you there tonight.
Yes.
And we'll give you a list of websites to stop reposting. That's our promise to you.
Satire Summit 2016 called Beyond Parody. Do you think of comedy and satire and parody as different things or the same things? Are they interchangeable words or Ashley, to what degree?
Oh, my goodness. So as someone who taught comedy theory at Columbia College,
Really?
Parody and satire are different things.
You can get credit for that?
This is something I've yelled into many students' faces. Parody looks like the thing it's making fun of. It shares that with satire, but satire has to have a political point. If you don't have a political point, you're not making satire. All those websites where they're just like, Joe Biden said something mean, and it's just not true. And then at the very bottom in a tiny little letters, it says, don't worry, it's satire. That's not satire. You have to both be funny and make a political point to be satire. It also has to look exactly like the thing. So if half your words are misspelled, then you don't look exactly like HuffingtonPost.com and you failed on every level of what satire is. But yeah, I have passion about that.
Alexandra, you want to get in on that?
No, I feel like often people, as you were saying, like they'll be like, oh, it's satire. Is there like get out of a bad joke free
yes.
card? And then like at the end of it, you'll be like it's just like you'll read like a page of just hateful, angry things. And then at the end, it'll be like, it was satire. I'm basically Jonathan Swift 2.0. Like the number of like guys on the internet who think they're Jonathan Swift always amazes me.
Those guys don't know who Jonathan Swift is.
I think like... they think he wrote, like, that book about the seagull or something.
Yeah.
Like...
Peter, you want to say anything more about that or about the summit? And
well,
what else
yeah.
is
I
be?
Mean, one of the things I've been saying a while is that these days, it's growing up basically over the course of my career at NPR, which is almost 20 years, this sort of satire industrial complex. There's so many people, really good people, some of whom are on the stage with me, some of whom are Samantha Bee or Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert. And the question is, A, why is there so much of it? B, why is it so good? And C, does it do any good? Which is really the ultimate question. Because, you know, you take Jonathan Swift and his famous, the founder of modern satire, his Modest Proposal, who wrote this amazing essay tearing apart the British for their treatment of the Irish by suggesting, hey, why don't we just eat their babies? That's great. Two questions. Didn't it stop the way they were treating the Irish? Did it have any effect? And the second reason, which is the question for us today, what do you do if they actually start eating the babies? What is left to say? And that is sort of something I think we're all struggling with.
And what is left to say? So it's the Satire Summit 2016. It's called Beyond Parody, an evening exploring why political satire is such a potent force in American culture and politics today. It's at 7:30 tonight. And I might have had the hall wrong. Where did you say it is?
And I have to look it up, but it is.
I have it at Star Foundation Hall at the New School. Is
no,
that
it's
wrong?
At the Tishman Auditorium in the New School. But if you go to the New School and ask for it, you'll find it. It's not that big a school, right?
Yeah, we'll give you our best recipes for cooking baby.
Sponsored by the News Literacy Project, and WNYC is a co-sponsor. We thank Satire Summit participants, Alexander Petri, Washington Compost columnist, Ashley Nicole Black, writer and correspondent on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, and Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Thank you all very much.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thank you,
thank
everybody.
Thank you, listeners. Thank you, audience, for coming to the Green Space this morning. And listeners, you can get tickets for our next Brian Lehrer Show, Green Space Show, 2 weeks from today, Friday, October 28th, at thegreenspace.org.